This is the Amanda Galas. You are listening to CKUT 90.3 FM.
You are listening to From Embers, a weekly show on CFRC 101.9 FM about anarchist and anti-authoritarian ideas and practice. We are broadcasting from the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples on land that has come to be called Kingston, Ontario, Canada, because of the thievery and brutality of the Canadian state and its empire-loving parents. From Embers is about fires, some real and some metaphorical. Fires started generations ago and tended to over the years. Little sparks all across this territory that we hope will grow, spread, and engulf the thieving state called Canada and the capitalist system that has plagued this land since the fur trade.
On this episode of From Embers, I'm happy to share this discussion I had with Carla Bergman. Carla is an artist, writer, unschooler, and fellow podcaster. Our listeners might be most familiar with the book Joyful Militancy, which she co-wrote with Nick Montgomery, or the podcast Silver Threads, which also features on the Channel Zero Anarchist Podcast Network. In this discussion, we talk about some of Carla's backstory, being radicalized by parenting, unschooling, the Purple Thistle, school closures during the pandemic, learning to trust kids, and striving to bring more joy into our projects and lives. You can find Carla's stuff on Twitter, Instagram, and Linktree at Joyful Carla. First of all, thank you so much for coming on From Embers. It's I'm a longtime listener, first time interviewer of you. And specifically your Grounded Futures and Silver Threads podcasts are things I've been following for a while and really appreciate the work that you do. Yeah, I'm just curious about some of your backstory, like how and where you grew up and how you came to get involved with all this.
Okay. Well, thanks so much for having me here. I really appreciate your show and all the work you do as well. And yeah, thanks for having me. Well, that's a big question. I'm in my 50s. Oh boy, I always put people on this, ask this question too. And it's like, well, that's so unfair. Where do I begin? I mean, you know, I grew up pretty working class, you know, on that kind of precipice of working class and poverty class. And then also on military bases until probably age 11. And I think that's just an important part to situate because, you know, it was very, this intersection of like nationalism. My mom worked for the federal government as well, as a, federal, like as a non-military servant, in mess halls and whatnot. And so she was really into unions and, you know, it would just, small leftist kind of environment, but more importantly was that mutual aid was like kind of this embodiment that was on the base, that was around me all the time. And, you know, I didn't know that. I reflected on that years later, but that kind of soldier's ethic, of, you know, no soldier left behind and, you know, we're a team and we take care of each other with all the problems around that. But how that like played out in community, back on the base was that's how, you know, it was very neighbor to neighbor, took care of everybody, fed people. It was just this flow of mutuality and cooperation and solidarity and care, that was just what we did. We just did it. Like, it wasn't, there's no pamphlets or handbooks or, you know, you didn't have to take a workshop. It was just how people showed up for everybody. And I think that's, happens in a lot of, smaller communities that are kind of cut off from maybe the rest of the dominant culture in one way or another. You know, for instance, like, I went to the school that was off site, because we didn't have a school on site, but the kids who, like the kids in my class who lived off base, they weren't allowed to hang out with me. You know, we were army brats, all the stuff. So I think that also is why we took care of each other, or why the parents banded together and took care of each other's kids and families. Yeah, and I don't have like a watershed moment per se about being an activist or a radical or whatever, because I just, and I see this in all kids all the time. Like, I just was that kid who, if I saw something happening, I just stepped in, you know, got between my brothers when they were fighting, whatever. It just seemed to be something I had a proclivity for, you know, and it ebbed and flowed throughout life, different issues, you know, like a lot of teens in a kind of more dominant culture home, like food politics. Like, I became a vegetarian in 1979, like pretty early. It's the chagrin of a lot of people in my life, adults. So like food politics, I dropped out of high school as a way to fight back against oppression and, you know, joined the punk scene. But it wasn't really rooted in any like deep politics or trying to change the larger system. I did, you know, nuclear war stuff and anti-Reagan stuff was really big in the early 80s. And I definitely went to those marches, but, you know, I went to them and then I went home. And that kind of like ebbed and flowed throughout my life. And then really having a kid is what really solidified a more, I guess, anarchy or an autonomous way of being or wanting to engage in creating prefigurative projects and thinking about how the borders, the social borders are built, and between, you know, whether it's between adults and kids or between families and movements, is one of the ones I was really irritated by. That's when things really changed. And at that time, and I think it's an important thing to point out is like, my son was born in 1994, and that's when the Zapatistas sort of came on the scene and in a public way. And they definitely embodied a lot of what just that, all those intersections of like autonomy and dignity and mutual aid and just all the ways that the Zapatistas interrupted a kind of leftist narrowing of how to be in the world that really reminded me of nationalism and certainty and all the things that I kind of am not into.
You said it was early for, like, you were an early vegetarian in terms of mm-hmm. vegetarianism wasn't a thing as much in, mm-hmm. in the dominant mm-hmm. culture. So how did you mm-hmm. come across that and what was happening? Because I don't know that history super well.
Right. And so I'm like the youngest of a large family, and I had an older sister who, like 11 years older than me, quintessential hippie of the 70s, right? And like lifestyle, you know, mm-hmm. really cared about the rights of Indigenous people and like was really ahead of her time and like in terms of the issues that she like cared about and that. But it was very back to land in a lot of ways. You know, so vegetarianism was at the center of all that and growing your own food. And, you know, they were building a boat to live on, like a beautiful wooden boat. And they like squatted. And so I had that influence, right. In the late 70s. And I'd go as a young teen, I'd go stay with her and, you know, she made her own tofu and all that. So my intro into it was really, you know, familial, which is kind of cool. And so I wasn't really in the larger, like, animal right. I didn't get to it from an animal rights place. It was more of an anti-capitalist wellness, you know, food is toxic, you know, that you get from the stores, that kind of approach.
And you said you dropped out of high school. Was that, like, a big decision for you at the time, or was it, like, were you just fed up?
Oh, yeah. Like the, it was not, you know, that was the ultimate. You were like a loser, like failure if you dropped out of high school. And it was one of these situations where I hadn't went to school for like 100 days. And the reason why I know this is because the vice principal called me up and said, you know, we have to fail you. Like we have a rule. It's like 100 days, miss classes, you can't pass. Maybe you should just drop out.
Right.
which was cool because it was a leverage that helped me have the conversation in an easier way with my parents. The vice principal thinks I should leave. but I had promised, I was like a super nerdy, like, you know, I was whatever, I was badass and caused all kinds of trouble for authority. But I also was like really like the things and it leads to unschooling. Like I realized years later that I was an unschooler even while I was in school. And what I mean by that is that I had just an appetite for learning things that I was interested in. And I dove deep. And so my parents saw that and they knew, you know, that it wasn't like for a lack of wanting to follow passions and do cool stuff. So I had said to them that I'll drop out, I'll wait a year, and then I'll apply to college and do college prep. And I did that. I dropped out of every institution I ever went to because I had a problem with institutions. So yeah, it was a mixed bag. But I also I think I only had one sibling who actually graduated from high school. So it wasn't, you know, also it's important to like get back to that working class piece. Like my mom actually valued like a work ethic more than a schooling ethic, you know? And so as long as I like had a job, she didn't care. And same with my siblings. Yeah. So that was a thread that ran through our life as well. In fact, when I, you know, got older and went to university in Toronto and, you know, kind of started pursuing an academic career. She wasn't impressed. Like she was kind of like, ugh.
Right. Just cut me off if this is too intrusive, but like, was having kids always something you wanted to do and part of the plan, or did it kind of just
not at all? I never get asked that question. Not at all. I was, did not have a good home life, which I, you know, that I don't want to talk about. So I was very much always liked kids, always, like I said, I was the youngest. So I had a lot of nieces and nephews, that were, you know, 9, 10, 11, 12 years younger than me. So I was still kind of like this teen kid around them. So at family gatherings or wherever, I always hung out with kids and I still, you know, that I will still probably end up with the kids at a gathering. So it wasn't for not connecting with them and liking them. I actually prefer hanging out with young people. I just couldn't imagine being a parent. I had other dreams and aspirations. And I wanted to pursue that and I didn't want to, and you know, whatever, probably the intersection of patriarchy and all kinds of stuff. And I remember like having a job that I was applying for like a higher management position and I was 26 or something. And the boss dude said, well, you just got like married. I bet you're going to have a kid. So probably shouldn't, you know, like, and I didn't even think to like sue him or.
Right.
So, you know, you got to realize that's kind of the era I grew up in, that was still happening. That would never happen now. Or if it did, it would just be a disaster for that man who said that. But yeah, I just didn't imagine having children at all. My kids are 10 years apart. So when I was like, okay, definitely only one kid.
Right.
You know, life changes.
Sure.
Yeah.
And I know you sort of said it already, but I think the quote that I wrote down is, it's been through the act of parenting that I was truly radicalized. It's mm-hmm. something that you say. Mm-hmm. Like, what do you mean by that? And how did that happen?
I think like I really remembered what it was like to be a kid and to be gaslit and kicked out of conversations and belittled and oppressed. And both my partner and I just have that real connection to our, what it was like. And maybe it's because we were both the youngest of large families. So it just like perpetuated and went on forever. It's two things. So just having to show up, I think by then I had already thought about anarchy and had read Kropotkin and, you know, The Dispossessed and all those things. And I was like, well, relationships with children is like really where it's at. Like if we can't be anti-authoritarian there, like like the seeds of hierarchy are just going to keep growing if the hierarchy's in the home. So I just felt like, it just deepened my commitment to those kind of ideals and values, because I had to, you know, I was challenged every single day on how to do that. And then my kid is neurodifferent, and watching the system, what they did with that was really what got me involved in a public way. Like, I think the first paper I presented to, you know, like a large audience was on Ritalin and on the drugging of children for exhibiting, you know, what I called quote unquote boyhood behavior. So it didn't matter what your gender was. It was, you know, fidgety and all these things. And that I called it SAD, Society Attention Deficit Disorder, and how schooling and institutions are the problem. And they, and that came directly from having a kid who was being targeted. And they were wrong. Like, they actually, I just fought it all along the way. And they were wrong. He doesn't have ADHD. He's actually on the autistic spectrum, but a very highly functioning one. So it would have been it would have been terrible if he had been drugged. So that those are the kind of two reasons why I say that.
And were you hooked into like a community of people or like a particular authors or something like that that were influencing your journey through that, or was that something you were just kind of experiencing and learning as you go?
The kind of de-schooling world, you mean, or like the child liberation?
Yeah, and just the radicalization sort of process of parenting.
That the books and the people came after. I guess the stuff that came before would be Kropotkin and sociology and Bookchin and stuff like that. In fact, and I haven't done the research myself, my friend Toby Rollo did it, but like in terms of Western theorists, political theorists, Kropotkin's probably the only one who doesn't throw children under the bus based on like just a basic opinion about rationalism and intelligence that, you know, you need to have language in order to be that. Kropotkin's probably the only one who doesn't hold that, which is so problematic because it's not actually just against young people. It's very ableist, right? A lot of people don't have speech or language, right? And they're some of the most poetic, intelligent people I know. So anyway, I sort of went off on a tangent, but they were kind of Emma Goldman too. I had read a lot of her stuff and she was very much against schools and stuff. So anarchy has a role. And then, it was through relationships. Like, I was at college, Langara College, and I used to bring my kid Zach everywhere with me. He's come to my philosophy classes and stuff. And, you know, having another student in the class who knew people that were involved in alternative education or alternatives to schools, and would say, you know, you should hook up with them. Like, you know, Zach would fit right in. And so it was just through word of mouth, and even right down to like how I met Matt Hearn. Like, we were went to a regular school. This was grade two for Zach. And I just really noticed his lights going out and his passion and his nerdiness of learning he was just getting so bored in school. And he had a decent teacher that year, so it was going well in terms of the other stuff. But it was actually at a field day, and another parent came up to me and said, you know, I've been watching Zach all day. Have you ever thought of him going to you guys being part of Windsor House School, which was the democratic non-coercive free school that ran publicly funded, that ran in BC here for 40 something years. And I was like, I've heard of it, but I can't imagine, like, it must have like a lineup forever, like a waiting list. She goes, actually, no, it doesn't, because people think that, I think. She goes, I'm Matt Hearn's my, do you know Matt Hearn? I was like, no, not at all. she's like, oh, he's my brother-in-law. You should like reach out to him and his partner, Selena. Selena's a teacher there. Anyway, so it was all like, it was all very relational and word of mouth. And so glad I ended up at that project because it was, it supported a, you know, working class family who couldn't afford to unschool or de-school. So it was really cool. And I did drop out of university though, in order to support it because it required a type of commitment that I needed to. And I think like my second day at Windsor House, I was in the library and Selena, who's Matt's partner, was putting books away and I had saw The Dispossessed and I was like, oh, my favorite novel of all time. And she's like, me too. And we got Scott talking. We started talking about sociology and Bookchin. And she's like, oh, you should meet my partner and go check out his project. I think you'd really fit in. And this was literally like my second day at Windsor House in 2000.
Wow. Yeah.
And The Thistle had only been going for about a year. So about a year later, I did go check out The Thistle with Zach. I was pregnant by then with my second kid. And then Kortikoff was there giving a talk. That's why I went. Who he co-founded Sociology Institute with Bookchin. And it was really cool. Like I had a great time. The kids were really great. But I, you know, I had like a 9-year-old and I was pregnant. I didn't, you know, it was a place for teens. So I was like, oh, this was not for me. But, you know, eventually it was. But
yeah. And we did do a previous interview with Matt Hearn where we talked a lot about this. But just for listeners who haven't heard that, can you sort of explain what the Purple Thistle was?
Yeah, sure. So it was a youth-run, I guess, like art and activism resource space that ran in Vancouver on Musqueam, Tsleil-Waututh, and Squamish lands from 2001 to 2015. And it was founded by Matt Hearn and six other youth with the idea of like, there was a couple of the kids who came through Windsor House and unschooling, but the rest were neighborhood kids who went to school. So this idea of like, creating a space for all kids to create a project for themselves. And that was kind of challenging a bunch of ideas around institutions and schooling and education. And it started from a place of asking the kids what they wanted to do together to thrive. And art and zine making and writing was the, and photography were the things that the first group of kids wanted to do. And that's why a space is what emerged. And it grew into being to be quite a large project. I started doing stuff there in about 2008. I ran a younger group called Young Guns that were my kid basically. And then the collective reached out to me, the larger collective, and asked if I wanted to be a co-director with Matt. And we did that for a couple of years together and then he moved on. And then I did that for a few years.
I'm curious about, you know, your experience as a parent in the Vancouver, you know, activist and anarchist kind of world. Like, did you find that there was room to participate in projects and be in those spaces as a parent?
Yeah. I mean, early on, not a lot. I definitely, you know, I have a bit of a narrative that when I want to do things, I have to create them.
Right.
And when I want to, you know, so, you know, and I'm really grateful for the youth and for Matt for having The Thistle, because that's exactly what, like, I was really frustrated. Like, I loved what Windsor House was and what it was doing and, you know, the couple hundred families that were part of it. That was amazing. But it still felt cut off from the neighborhood and where I lived and the kids who couldn't be in school or couldn't opt out of school and kids who needed to get away from their parents, quite frankly. Like, so I was started to think about like, how can we have this place where all kids could come together? That's why I did Young Guns. And then, so I just wanted to say, I didn't have to create The Thistle, cause that was a place mm-hmm. where obviously my son and I were like, he was on the collective for the whole time I was the co-director. So that was very much a blurring of those lines. But yeah, I remember my youngest like going to a meeting and just them being like, I'm done. Like, I'm not doing this anymore. And he's the one I do Grounded Futures with. So it's not like he's not open and like wanting to do cool stuff. But I remember in Joyful Militancy, Nick and I, in the book, we interviewed Leanne Simpson about like, how can we like, you know, break down these social borders and invite families in and kids in more. She's like, the first thing you got to do is we got to completely change how we meet, because kids don't want to sit in a 7-hour meeting. You know, mm-hmm. like who, I mean, I don't thrive in those environments either. And so like the Thistle was always this idea of like, you know, we only met 1 hour a week. That was it. The rest of it was, we were doing shit. We were like out in the streets, connecting with community, making art, pursuing our own art collectively or not, you know, it was a collective of collectives. Yeah. So I think about that a lot and to this day, because I still don't see that happening like that. You know, there's just this impulse to go back to how it's always been done, how we come together, how we plan, how we organize, how we do movement building. And some people are better at it. They'll offer free daycare at the meetings, but that's not fun for kids either. That's not what I was looking for, right? And on the flip side, I'm also not into, which is another impulse of movement builders, is to, you know, do movement building for children. Let's teach children how bad the world is.
Right.
It's like, ugh. Right. You know?
Because it's like pedantic or whatever.
It's pedantic. It's insulting. I mean, I think one of the stories I often tell is like the way that ageism works in movement building is, so the Thistle was this dynamic place. You got to realize like every group used it to come and make banners and like for free, placard, you know, silk screen, like, and they got to use it for, you know, on the backs of like mostly Matt's. Matt wouldn't probably like that I said this, but he wrote a lot of grants to make that happen. And then I took over that and some of the youth did that with me. But so, you know, almost every organizing group that you can think of in Vancouver at some time at that, in that era, used the space to either meet or make art for their various things for free. And I would still get emails from these mini groups offering to come in and teach the Thistle youth how to be an activist or how to run a meeting or how to run a space. And I was like, are you kidding? I'm pretty sure you all could learn from this youth, this group of youth who like not only like have figured out how to meet once a week in a way that's convivial and generous and they feed each other and they take care of each other, but run, keep this place open 7 days a week or 6 days a week for y'all to use. like they ran the place. They had keys to the place. Like I was there maybe an hour or two a week tops, unless I was making art myself. I didn't have an office there. Like they ran the place. Like my kid had his 3-hour a week shift and it was all volunteerism and he ran the dark room and he taught adults probably more than I could remember how to make films and develop film. And yet, you know, I was like, wow, I've been on collectives with all different groups and the most functioning has been this youth group. So maybe they should offer a workshop.
Yeah. How did that happen? Why was it so functional?
I mean, I also want to say like relationships are hard. It didn't mean that we didn't have hard points and that people didn't leave angry sometimes and things didn't get weird sometimes. Like, of course, sure. It's relational. Things are hard. I think it's like, it's that idea of, it kind of comes back to anarchism. You know, it's kind of a tenet of anarchism of like, if the conditions are such, then people show up well. And I think it's in the very idea of like, there was no pedagogy, there was no blueprint, there was no handbook. It was really based on this idea of like, there's some scaffolding, like, you know, the couple adults who anchor the place, make sure that, you know, it's not going to get closed tomorrow. So they write grants and they get the permits from the city and they be an ally with a direct ally with the adult world. So there's that scaffolding that's in place and there's like these kind of anarchist-y ideas of mutual aid and cooperation and volunteerism that's at play. But otherwise, it's really up to the group of youth who are running the place to decide what happens in that place. And that really did happen. Like there's groups of collectives who were all just super into tech And it shifted, like the Thistle shifted away from being like this major like art making place to like, you know, there was computers everywhere. And then 2 years later, the collective would kind of do this transition. And then it was like a rebirth of analog, like, you know, sewing, like there's, you know,
you'd walk in,
there'd be like 10. So it really did follow the group that was running the place. Interests, and they worked together too, and there's only so many resources, so they had to work it out and they had to talk about it. And I think you know, it was just, people would ask like, did you teach the kids how to do consensus? And I'm like, no, well, first of all, we didn't do like, nothing was rigid, right? So it was very informal. It was just, it was really a group of friends coming together and talking about shit. And but mostly it was about doing stuff, and I think that's the piece, right? Like, people just, whether we were doing guerrilla gardening, making zines, making films, doing movie nights, whatever.
You're listening to From Embers, airing first on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston. You can also find our podcast episodes online at fromembers.libsyn.com. We're about halfway through my interview with Carla Bergman, who is an artist, writer, unschooler, and fellow podcaster. I think the thing that moved me to reach out to you in the first place was I was just listening to the radio, and there was a piece on the radio about school closures in Ontario and how it was like this debate between like safety in terms of, you know, COVID and whether opening schools would lead to increased transmission, what that would mean for like the broader community transmission, versus this idea that kids needed to be in these institutions to be healthy and that they would, you know, and it wasn't even about academics or marks or success or something. It was mostly about the idea that kids were dependent on the institution of school for their well-being, which I don't think is 0% true in this society, like as it is or whatever, for kids who do rely on that. But it really made me want to sort of unpack that in terms of like, how do we make kids dependent on these institutions for their health? And despite, you know, all these critiques that point out how school is really unhealthy or really destructive to the creative impulses and self-direction and all these important things. Like, I don't know, do you just have like a reaction to the way that that's framed? Because I really wanted to talk about that in a better way.
Yeah, I mean, oh boy, like the conversation around schooling with the pandemic has been really interesting, because I like, you know, people who have been doing this work way longer than me, like I have a friend in Mexico and one in India, and they're like, this is amazing. Like the veil's being torn off and people are seeing how like schools aren't good. Like it's just, it's spreading almost as fast as COVID. Mm-hmm. I was like, I don't think that's true. Like, I think, yes, there is, people are understanding, but like the problem, oh, there's a couple, I have so many things to say. sorry. When the pandemic first, you know, was happening, I was reached out by a few journalists to write about, you know, advice to parents on how, how to bring the ethos of unschooling into the home during this time. And like, the first thing I said is like, well, first of all, this is not unschooling. Like, this is devastating. Like, unschooling is about being in the world, whatever that is, like whether it's, you know, spending all your time in the forest or whatever, in a textbook, or reading fantasy novels, or working with various different mentors and learning skills. Like, it's so dynamic and the opposite of isolation, like the opposite. You know, I think it gets conflated with a very particular kind of homeschooling that's about keeping kids safe away from the world. Mm-hmm. You know, so right away I was like, no. But then I was like, of course, you know, just trust the kid. Like, most of us adults were traumatized by what was happening for various reasons. Underlying health issues, people in their life who were, it was a very scary time. You know, my partner was a frontline worker. You know, I just, there was all different things going on why we were stressed, and to expect kids not to even be more stressed or as much stressed was boggling to me. And so I was just like, why can't they just have a break? Like, take the frickin' year off of school. Like, mm-hmm. you know, that was my advice. Unless, you know, like I had a couple of young people in my life who were in private schools, and like school was everything in their worldview, like how they were being raised. Like, they had to get the marks to get into the best universities, and they were in their, you know, in 2020, they were in their, you know, grade 11 and grade 12. And that was, it was devastating for them. And I was like, you know, on the flip side, support that kid to get the best grades they can right now, because that's what they want. Like, it all comes back to trusting the kid, even if it you don't agree with what they need. And yeah, and just thinking that school's a place good for health is, of course, it's wrapped up in the whole idea that like socialization gets conflated with having a social life, which are two different things. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just think it's super complex. You can't solve the school problem until we, like, it's all connected to capitalism and the other systems of oppression that hold us down. Like, there's just, like, I have a lot of friends in the U.S. with little kids, and, like, you know, COVID's running through their families because they have to keep sending their kids to school because they have to work. I mean, they just have to. And the only free childcare they have is elderly parents who they don't, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
it's just, there's no quick answer or quick recipe on how to solve this issue. But the rhetoric is, I agree with you, it's really frustrating. And also, like, a couple of those kids I was mentioning earlier, like, school was the only place they felt safe. Like, their home life was terrible. Like, they were trans, or they were, are facing other, you know, neural differences or whatever. They had things going on in their life that they had to mask at home. But they didn't have to mask at school, ironically, parent, you know? So there's that piece too.
Yeah, right? Sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And obviously, like, I don't know what it looked like in BC, but in Ontario, school, what quote unquote school closures look like, was actually having to be on Zoom many hours a day doing all the same things that you do at school, but over, like, mediated by this screen where you can't, there's no recess where you can hang out with your friends in between. So, I mean, it's terrible. Pretty obvious why many kids would prefer to go back to school and see their friends compared mm-hmm. to being locked inside and on the computer all day. But I also know lots mm-hmm. of people who just put their foot down with the schools that their kids were in and just said, like, you know, maybe my kid will come to the Zoom class like an hour a day, but I'm like, they're not going to sit there all day long. I'm going to do some other stuff with them. And a lot of teachers were actually, you know, making a lot of accommodations for that. And I kind of wonder if there's, you know, because of those experiences, people are realizing that there are other ways that they could be engaging with the institution in terms of, like, I've even heard of people who are interested in unschooling, but don't want to fully take the jump. And they talk about, well, maybe one day a week, you know, us and a mm-hmm. bunch of other parents could pull our kids out of school and do something else with them, go for a walk in the woods or whatever.
Totally. I love that. That's totally been an outgrowth or a bloom that's happened. I've seen that a lot. It's really exciting because, of course, the whole idea that learning and schooling, or education and learning, are go together is it's actually deadly wrong, and undermines all kinds of ways that we can find thriving through learning. Like, that's what humans do. We learn, like, we learn all the time, and we learn from each other and from our more than human friends out there. So that's really exciting to me that I'm seeing that as well. And it's mm-hmm. really exciting to see. Yeah. And also that, like, really high school should just be abolished. Like, that's just, like, let's be real. Like,
yeah.
The way that it's run, like, it's, you know, school is daycare. All school, we don't need that. No one should do anything 5 days a week. Work, you know, this is like a work issue too. This is a capitalist issue. And it just follows the capitalist model. But and so people realizing that, like, a kid maybe only needs an hour 3 days a week or something of an actual instruction to then go on and do cool stuff. Like, yeah, like my kid does his own kind of directed learning, but the one I was just talking about, our Liam, who does Grounded Futures with me, doing Ground at Futures gave him like three credits, like he got a credit for media, cool. Arts 11, social studies, and English, because he wrote like because of the people we had on, the conversations we have. And he was, you know, the teacher listened to the episode and like, oh, wow. Okay. Right.
Right. Here's some grades.
You know? Yeah. Yeah. And so I'm really interested in that. And there's, we're hopefully going to have somebody on who know, like is really skilled at like playing the system. Like you can get your grade 12 with like minimal effort, in BC anyway. And it's, yeah. but that information's kept from parents, right? It's completely kept from them. It's not easy to find. So mm-hmm. yeah, that's what I mean by abolish high school. I don't mean abolish learning. I don't mean abolish skill sharing. I don't mean abolish like, rigorous instruction if you're into physics or whatever. Like there, you know, I'm not saying you can learn physics through osmosis. I'm not like a freaking crackpot. Like I just mean like the Monday to Friday, you know?
Yeah.
Wasted hours. Like the teens that I know that didn't go to high school, they got to work on other stuff and they didn't land in their 20s just freaked right out about everything, you know?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. There's this big, you know, discussion in Ontario right now ahead of the election about the 4-day work week going on. Mm-hmm. And I will say as a 4-day worker, it sucks too. And it should be less than four.
Oh, do you mean like work? Oh, no, I can only do that like 2 days a week.
I've noticed and appreciate that you center this, you know, the question of trust a lot in a lot of your work, and I know you're working on a book called Trust Kids. Why do you think this culture encourages us to not trust kids? Like, how did that happen, or why does that happen, and what would it take to change that?
Whew, good question. If you actually commit to trusting kids, it means like how that plays out in the day to day is there's a whole pile of things that aren't going to go the way you planned. Like,
right.
You know, whether it's what you have plans for their whole entire life, or for the day or whatever, like, so just that off the front, like that, it's just inconvenient, I think, for a lot of parents, like really early on. And, you know, like I've never met a baby who didn't trust the adults around them, because it's actually what we do to survive. They trust you 100%, and we immediately, well, not everybody, there's a lot of amazing people there, but a lot of people chip away at that trust and they break it. Whether, you know, it's through sleep training, whatever. There's all kinds of stuff that undermines that beautiful trust that's flowing at you from day one. But my kind of the person who I found after I got into doing that, living this, was John Holt. He coined the term unschooling, and he was prolific in writing about trusting kids. And he created an after-school program that was very much like the Thistle, because he saw the problems with doing it, you know, just benefiting the families who could afford it. And he didn't have children of his own. I think this is a really important piece, because it's not about being a parent only. Mm-hmm.
Totally.
His whole thing was like, we don't, you know, trusting kids is the most important thing we need to do. And the reason why we aren't very, and why it's hard and why we're not so good at it, is because we weren't trusted as kids. We have all kinds of like charge around it, hurt around it. And it's just this, you know, ongoing generational problem, right? But it's definitely goes back to what I was saying earlier about all the intersecting forms of oppression that are at play, right? So it's in, you know, the kid has to go to sleep because I got to work at 5 a.m, right? Like, mm-hmm. it's all happening at once. So, yeah, but. Like, to me, trust is about, it's connected for us anyway. The way that we approached it in our home was like, we were more interested in a relationship-centered home than a child-centered home. And what I mean by that is like, it's just, I'm not talking about when they were babies. I'm talking about when their kids are older. It's about showing up for each other. And like, the goal is that we're all going to thrive. So I think child-centered homes hit a wall pretty quickly because of what I mentioned, unless they have a tremendous amount of privilege. Yeah. Because it is inconvenient. We just all have to compromise, all of us, at different times. And so I started using the term solidarity begins at home instead, because it's something that can happen immediately. Some of my political theorist friends are like, you should use justice begins at home. And I'm like, no, I don't mean that. I'm not talking about being in solidarity with each other and our needs and our, yeah. So trust is like really, really connected to responsibility and being there for each other for me.
Yeah. And like, this is a weird connection I made in my head maybe, but I was thinking about a zine about security culture that came out last year that was also talking about centering trust and actually, security culture in anarchist circles as a practice that is geared towards building trust, because so often security culture is framed as this what not to do and who to avoid and who to be suspicious of and that kind of thing. Whereas this text I thought was really good and talked about, quote, shifting our focus from fear to confidence, from risk aversion to courage, from isolation to connection, and from suspicion to trust. And obviously it's not the exact same thing as what it would mean to trust kids. But it does seem related to that. And I think that's something I really like about it.
Yeah, cool. I haven't read that, but it was definitely, it does resonate. And it's definitely a big part of like what Nick and I pulled like for Joyful Militancy. Like we didn't give a roadmap or a blueprint on any of it, but we do talk about the idea of trust. And it comes back to that idea of like kill the cop in your head. Like a lot of it is when we're just in that framework, then we're just going to replicate and behave like the state in lots of ways with each other. And it doesn't have to be like intense. It can just be really informal. Like at the Thistle, like a lot of the Thistle youth were in their 20s. Lots were in their teens, but a lot were in their 20s. They just knew that they could call us if something was going on, if they had like a violent situation happening in their collective home. Like they didn't call the cops. They call, I remember me and my partner on Christmas Eve went over and helped them, And that couldn't have happened if there wasn't a foundation of trust in place, right? And there were some kids who were really street involved in that were part of that house who didn't have that precondition, that relationship with me, and definitely not with my partner. I remember them just being like freaked right out, right? Like just, hiding and... glaring at us, and it took a lot of work to gain their trust in that moment. But it's a commitment to not call the cops sometimes when there's like a violent interaction happening by an outside person mm-hmm. in your home, right?
And I do think it, like, I'm glad you brought up Joyful Militancy, because I think it does connect to the way that you describe joy in that text as I wrote down a collective process that transforms us into something more capable. And I think about, building each other up as opposed to tearing each other down. And I think that this also, like, this is about parenting, but like, that's a question in parenting, but it's also a question in anarchist organizing spaces that I've been involved with, where people are asking these questions about how do we create the conditions in which somebody who's newer to a project, or doesn't fit in instantly or whatever, for whatever reason, can be made to feel comfortable and confident to take on new roles and initiatives. But it's hard. Do you have any advice for people who are thinking through some of these questions?
Yeah, that's a hard one. If anything came up at the Thistle, conflict at the Thistle over the year was at times when it would get sedimented and rigid. We also have a tendency towards forgetting what it was like when we were just learning things. I always think of, I think Malcolm X has that thing, like, don't forget the time when you didn't know the thing, don't condemn everybody. But you know, again, to me, it's entangled in empire and whiteness. And it's anytime I see that happening, all I see is colonialism and whiteness at play. Like that, those are strategy. Those are tactics of whiteness and colonialism. That there's one way, and it's my way, and everyone must assimilate. I try to every now and again, like really amplify, like the mentors and the folks who welcomed me in, and how grateful I am that they didn't shut me down when I said the wrong thing, or I share stories. See, this is what happened with Joyful Militancy. The minute, like if I said, well, there's these 10 steps you can do, well, I'm kind of getting rigid, right? Because it's not actually paying attention to the people in the room, like what they need and what their predilections are and all this stuff.
Right.
Yeah, I think sometimes it just gets muddied. Like I think sometimes some people are, you know, people should be encouraged and allowed to come together based on their affinities and their ideologies. Like, sure. Right. But if you're doing a public project or you're trying to like create change in the anarchist-y, deep autonomous way, like then, you know, you want to challenge those notions. And I have learned it's awkward to talk about it. Like if when people interview me and Nick, he always brings it up. But like when we did a social spaces summit 2 years in a row through the Thistle, and invited people in from mostly North America, because, you know, it was too expensive for people to come from elsewhere. And we did open space kind of workshopping, and people came and talked to, and it was more people who run social spaces to talk about what the issues, and these issues were the big ones. And it really influenced the book Joyful Militancy, because it was in 2012 and 2013 that we did it. And one of the things that I, with the organizing collective that I worked with, is I was like, so there's a couple things that set the tone right away that make people feel unwelcomed. Number one is to, when you first get together, you sit in a big circle and you show your badges to each other. You know who shows badges? Cops. Like, let's not show each other our badges. Let's like let's have the first night be about inviting some musicians in, about making food together, about like talking about how we want the summit to go, have an open space thing where we like do the schedule together as a group. And throughout that weekend, like people, I think actually Cindy Milstein wrote about it, like how they were like, you know, just joy was everywhere that weekend. I mean, that's my advice.
Right. Yeah.
You know, like don't replicate some of the ways in which that, you know, I don't know anybody who thrives in that circle. Like maybe the two extroverts in the group. Because, you know, I don't even think you have to be shy or awkward to not thrive in that group. It's more about like, you know, people start talking about who they are and what they do. And then it just, the competition gets in there. The insecurities get in. Like it just dampens the group.
I think another thing too is sometimes we consciously or unconsciously create this hierarchy of like roles or skills, and, you know, imagine that certain roles are more important than others, and mm-hmm. And don't recognize people's skills that they have as skills, and create like space for people to basically do what they want to do within different spaces and groups.
It really resonates for me, because like I am not a big F facilitator like at all, and because of the work I've done, people always want to, like over the years, no one does anymore because they now know, but I would get invited in to facilitate, like, you know, groups having a hard time, or, you know, the big huge gathering of like various different groups collectives coming together to plan, and that it would be a disaster, because I'm just not, like, my skill is actually thinking about like that larger stuff and being behind the scene and space holding, right? And relationship check-ins and like supporting people behind the scenes. That's why I work with, why kids work well with me, right? Because I'm a tone mm-hmm. checker, and that's a huge undervalued skill, right? But I'm not the big like, hey everybody, boom, boom, boom.
Get your flip chart.
You know, like, yeah, here's the chart, and go, and have like the right questions at the right time, and like can weave the what people are saying. I'm way too shy, neural different, like all the things, bored usually.
Yeah, I think sometimes there's a lot of pressure on people to assimilate into those roles that they don't actually necessarily mm-hmm. want to take on because they're prioritized or seen as like necessary to be a full, you know, member of something or participant of something. And sometimes I feel like, yes, we do want to encourage people to pursue whatever interests that they have or expand their skills in whatever ways that they want to. But we also, you know, like that doesn't have to be about pressuring people to take on things that they don't really actually want to take on.
Exactly. Yeah.
So I do know people who are really interested in unschooling or school resistance, and but they don't know where to start, and they are in that kind of position where they've got to go to work and can't consider like mm-hmm. paying for school. Exactly. Do you have advice for people who are looking for that?
The big one is to, one of the things that sort of the dominant order tries to convince us really early on, and it fits into the whole scheme of things, but I'm just going to talk about parenting here for a second, is that once you commit to one line of flight, that's the one you're on. So if you are doing school, it's forever. If you're unschooling, that's what you're doing. And the first thing I would try to demystify is to not get too caught up in that. Like, I really like the term odd schooling. Like, I would say my kids are odd schoolers more than unschoolers. My oldest has like a master's now, like whatever, like it's not, and I am a school resistor in my heart, but I also understand what's happening around me, in the, so, you know, in the intersections. And so like, yeah, just, really listening to your kid too, and letting your kid own their education and their learning. I mean, I could spend a long time being an education resistor more than a school resistor, because education, right, I think, is where it gets really messed up. But like, you know, because unschooling can become rigid too, right? Like, if you want to go to school in the neighborhood, we'll make it happen. If you want to become a neuroscientist, then, you know, there's things we got to do. You can't just be an unschooler. But if you're an artist, it's different, right? Like, it's, yeah. So just keep open, keep curious, keep the conversation going, build a learning collective with other parents. There, if you're thinking it, probably other families are thinking it, you know, and I'm white, but I also, to make it work, we got roommates and all kinds of things early on, but the majority of the people in the early days, they were middle class, and I had to just deal with some classism stuff constantly around, like, you know, the tiny, whatever, mold infested house we lived in compared to their beautiful homes and whatever, right? Like, I just had to, I don't want to out the person, but another Indigenous scholar writer once said to me, like, she calls bullshit on the, like, I can't afford to unschool my kids, because I think what maybe you need to say is, I want to actually own a house one day so I can unschool my kids. Like, you need to actually reframe it a little bit, because I have many friends, including us, who have no nest egg by making this decision, who lived in the projects as a single parent so that their kid didn't have to go to school because the kid didn't want to go to school or was being bullied or wasn't thriving. So that's my more hard line, but I think it's an important thing to bring up. I kind of just want people to be more honest and say,
yeah,
because I feel gaslit by them when they say, oh, so cool, you're so brave. Like, I just couldn't do it. We just couldn't afford it. And meanwhile, they, you know, they own their $2 million house.
Right.
Like, don't tell me you can afford it. Like,
yeah.
CKUT is a messenger, teaching the youth about roots and culture, and tell them I see them to remember. That's all I need when I am. Well, CKUT is a messenger, teaching the youth about roots and culture, and tell them I see them to remember. That's all I need when I am. Well, 90.3 FM. It's CKUT, the cultural radio station. Radio McGill. Blessed love. The messenger. Take it away.
Pangea de Futura is a mega jam collective comprised of many veterans of the Montreal music scene. A wide range of tectonic plates coming together, making the world stop for a second and ripping these continents apart. CKUT 90.3 FM is proud to present their concert in collaboration with CHYZ 94.3 on Sunday, May 22nd at 3 p.m. at the 38th Festival International de Musique Actuelle de Victoriaville. For all the details on the 38th FIMAV, visit fimav.qc.ca.
Being vaccinated against COVID-19 doesn't protect you from this. Or this.
Mom, what's for dinner?
Not this. This.
And it's looking like rain, rain, and more rain for this weekend.
This. Or even this.
Your call is important to us. Please hold.
But being vaccinated does protect you from the virus. Vaccination is still your best form of protection. A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
Ladies and gentlemen, friends and comrades all over the world, we welcome you to Amandla this week on CQUT 90.3. And we have an interesting lineup I think you're going to enjoy tonight. Gwen, what did you find?
Well, basically, this was something that Zara Malou turned me on to. She's currently in Kenya and has, I think, dove in quite deeply into the world of podcasting in Africa right now, which is an incredibly exciting landscape. But what she pointed me to was an article in The Guardian called From the Ranting Atheist to I Like Girls, the best African podcasts, covering topics from queer Africans to a blogger's disappearance. Female hosts and producers from across Africa pick their top shows. So it's a great article. I would definitely refer you to it. It's in The Guardian, came out recently, and there's about 10 or so podcasts in there that they briefly describe. Most of them are multi